Welcome everyone to today's webinar. This is number 449 for CH Networks. We're a project here at the University of Ottawa. Our topic today is Screening of Children and Youth New to Canada, a Practical Approach and Tools for Care Providers. Today is June 10th, 2015, and we're delighted to work with the Canadian Pediatric Society on today's webinar. And we're going to introduce you to the project called Caring for Kids New to Canada. I'm on slide number 2. We have two presenters today, Dr. Tony Barozzino, and he is the assistant professor of the Department of Medicine at the University of Toronto and a director of Community Outreach and Ambulatory Services at St. Michael's Hospital. And Dr. Susan Kuhn, who is the associate professor and head of Section of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at the Department of Medicine at the University of Alberta. She is the pediatric ID consultant at Alberta's Children's Hospital. And over to slide number 5. Here are your presenters. We have Sue here on the left, and then the second picture, this is Tony here on the right. And I'll go to slide number 6 and over to Tony.
Well, thank you, Dot. And first of all, I'd like to thank all of you in attendance today, as well as the Canadian Pediatric Society and Child Health Networks for the invitation to speak to you, and as well your enthusiasm for this topic, which is clearly near and dear to our hearts. In case you can't tell from the deep voice, I'm Dr. Tony Barozzino, and I'm a general pediatrician in inner city Toronto. And my co-conspirator slash co-presenter today is Dr. Susan Kuhn, a pediatric ID specialist from Calgary. And Sue and I have spent a lot of time together, and in fact a significant part of the last 3.5 years working on the CKNC web resource, from its humble beginnings out of a think tank meeting in Ottawa to development of actual site content and then to its launch in 2013. And now it's our privilege and frankly our duty to spread the gospel of CKNC, as I like to call it, and help raise awareness of the healthcare challenges for newcomer children and youth in Canada. This first slide, slide number 6, it's just outlining some of the objectives for today. So we will try to give you a brief overview of the pediatric migrant health issues and why we developed the Caring for Kids New to Canada web resource. I'll be reviewing some of the screening resources specifically from the website itself, and Sue will take over thereafter and introduce the e-checklist as a screening tool, as well as going over some case presentations. And in case you're not familiar with the website, here's the CKNC homepage. And frankly, if there's only one thing you remember after today, I really ask that it be this web link, www.kidsnewtocanada.ca and www.enfantsneocanadien.ca. But before we go any further, before we proceed, there are a few quick questions we'd like to ask you, audience members. So first of all, who are you? As you can see, doctor, nurse, administrator, public health worker, other. Not that you're defined as a person by your career, but it's important information nonetheless for our purposes. So we'll give you a few seconds to answer the poll.
That's great, thanks. So far we've got about 7 doctors, 3-4 nurses, no administrators, 1 administrator, and 3 public health workers, and 3 in the other category. Thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to hide that poll and we can go on to your next slide.
All right, so thank you for that first poll question being answered. Here's question number 2, slide number 10. Where are you in Canada? And please don't read too much into the lumping together of the Maritimes or the territories, as this was strictly for ease, speed, and space considerations, not trying to be controversial in any way. As I can see, we have smattering from most places. 8 from Ontario, Quebec is represented, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, Labrador, Saskatchewan, and unfortunately no one from BC or Alberta, but maybe we can spread that out. It's too early in the morning for that group out there, I think.
There we go. So I'll close that and we'll go on to your next slide, which is
slide number 11. Yeah. So question number 3, do you deal with immigrant refugee children and youth? Rarely, occasionally, often, or daily? And again, this is our hope is that we, in some way, shape, or form, are preaching to the choir, as they say. We assume that most of you do have an interest in immigrant refugee children and youth, but it will be interesting to know if you're frequent care providers, infrequent, rare. And it looks like we have, again, a bit of a representation across the board almost, but often and daily. So lots of individuals who do immigrant refugee pediatric work regularly.
Okay, so I'll hide that. Oh, we've got another one.
Right, and these are the last two before we get started. So 4A, have you used the CKNC website before? And then the second part to that question will be, if yes, how often? Really wanting to know if you have used it before, and if you have you found it useful enough to want to go back and use it either for clinical purposes, education, or advocacy? And it looks like about almost two-thirds have not used the website before, and one-third have. And maybe we can put up the second part of the question now. So if you have, occasionally. All right, well, thank you very much for that. That's a little bit of housekeeping, and we appreciate your input. Now let's move on to the actual discussion for today. So first, we'd like to give you a brief overview of the evolution and development of the CKNC web resource. I always feel compelled to do this to help justify my biases. I'm obviously intimately involved with the development of this web resource. And personally, I think that you all should have it marked in your favorites tab on your computer, and my goal is to someday have you all have an app on your phone that you can look at. So we'll just go over a bit of the evolution. Then I'll be providing you with a brief outline and flavor for some of the ways that the CKNC website can be used to help with the medical assessment and screening of children and youth new to Canada, but keeping in mind that the medical assessment piece alone is probably a 90-minute webinar unto itself. And then finally, Sue will do the heavy lifting and discuss the e-checklist, which essentially she has helped design to help with the care of immigrant and refugee children and youth, and which is also available on the site. And she'll use some cases to help illustrate the utility of the resource, and then finally we'll open it up to some questions. So why and how did we get started on this project? I guess the first question we have to ask ourselves is, why did we think it was an important topic to address in the first place? I mean, children and youth come to Canada from all regions of the world. In 2011, 250,000 individuals became permanent residents of Canada, including immigrants and refugees. And although this number has varied over time, and it also has varied in terms of the percentages that are economic immigrants versus family class immigrants, the one thing that has remained consistent is that almost 20% of new permanent residents are children when they arrive, and that's only looking up to 15 years of age. Now, this percentage is within the matching percentage of children within Canada overall in terms of the population. Now, where do they go? Here's a pie graph showing where these individuals tend to end up. And again, this is from 2011, but as you can see, Ontario, Quebec, and British Columbia make up 75% of the landing spots for immigrant and refugee families. But there is no part of Canada that's not represented, and the trends change with the changes in economic opportunities, changes in government policies and incentives, as well as the demographics of the immigrants themselves. And to make an example for good measure, this is a picture that we've used in presentations in the past. This is Whitehorse, and in 2011, 218 immigrants settled there. So this is just to say any healthcare provider anywhere can be faced with immigrant refugee patients, young or old. Now, where do they come from? Well, again, this changes all the time, but it can depend on the political landscape in Canada and around the world, geopolitical upheavals, humanitarian needs, etc. And even this information, again from 2011, is now several years old and would likely be misrepresenting the countries of origin today. A good example, obviously, is the group from Hungary, which was representative of the population of Roma refugees who came to Canada, and this has significantly changed over the last several years. What about their language ability? Obviously, this too varies with the change in demographics, but I think the important thing to note is that one quarter of the individuals new to Canada have neither English nor French as a language which they speak, which clearly in and of itself is a significant barrier when it comes to accessing health care. And other issues that provide barriers to care, I think that anyone who works or has interfaced with the immigrant refugee population knows that they face significant barriers, including things that impede their access to care, diminish their the equity of the care that they receive, and also change the ability to follow through on care recommendations due to these many factors, and only some of which are really listed here. How about culture and its influence on healthcare and health outcomes? I love this iceberg analogy here because I think it highlights how many elements of culture are obvious, but some are less obvious. And we know that culture significantly influences healthcare and health outcomes. But the iceberg analogy here is not just representative of the quote-unquote what lies below the surface component of culture, but it also reminds me that like an iceberg, the heft or the significance of that hidden material can lead to catastrophic consequences if it's not paid attention to. And I think, again, anybody who works with this population has probably experienced a situation where something previously unseen or not thought of has come up in their day-to-day management. So with all of that in mind, we embarked on the CKNC journey, and eventually it evolved into a knowledge transfer and exchange project. And our objective really is has been ultimately to improve the health equity and health outcomes for children and youth new to Canada. And I put this slide up. It's a little bit busy, but just to bear with me, this is really just to try to quickly capture the scope of the project and the extent to which the group went to try to make sure that the product would ultimately be a highly accessible and useful resource for individuals working with this population of children. So everything from an initial needs assessment and a think tank group to get together and figure out what the issues at hand would be, looking for funding, developing an infrastructure through the CPS and the editorial board across the country, months and months of content development and peer review, ultimately to e-publication, and then a feedback loop including audience review and development of new content. And we're now in those bottom phases where we're disseminating, we're reaching out to our users, we're planning new cycles of development, and we're looking for ways to sustain it. And as mentioned in the introduction, this took almost 3 years from the genesis to the product launch and countless hours of work. And we're particularly proud of the iterative nature of the development cycle with numerous retooling points based on feedback from multiple sources. We believe that this looping back to the end user will help us to continue to improve the product and keep it relevant. And although it's not exactly Wikipedia, we'll do our best to kind of keep it moving forward. We also are now at a phase where we have completed the development of the web resource and have moved on to the task force component of CKNC, where subcommittees have been formed which can focus on research areas, education, clinical care provision, and patient resource development. And one of the highlights of coming through this process is that, in fact, although we tried to do our best to develop evidence-based guidelines, what became quickly clear is that there's not a lot of evidence out there, particularly in the Canadian context. And this is a picture of our editorial board members at one of our CPS meetings, but there were many, many other people involved from across the country and across disciplines, physicians, nurses, pediatricians, family physicians, public health individuals, individuals in academic centers or from the community. All in all, over 150 editors, contributors, and reviewers were involved, and virtually all of them volunteered their time and energy for this topic that they were clearly passionate about. Again, a very Canadian thing for us to do, I think. And The results has been the CKNC website, which is an online, bilingual, free, and up-to-date resource for all individuals who provide medical care to new Canadian children and youth and their families. And the hope being that it also represents the best available evidence out there when we're making recommendations to you, the frontline care providers. But how can it be of use? Well, here's just one example. There's information available on the web resource, both for practitioners as well as resources that can be accessed and disseminated to families. Here's another screenshot. We're now on slide 31. I'm sorry, I've forgotten to keep you abreast of that, but slide 31. Things like practical information, such as the facts about medical coverage for immigrant and refugee families. And this is both federal information as well as provincial links to help address local differences. Slide 32. This is a screenshot of one of our guidelines, which can help for individuals looking to help newcomers overcome barriers to healthcare. These are excellent downloadable resources for your offices, your clinics, and they can be used for multiple purposes, including education and advocacy. Slide 33 is using an interpreter with children, youth, and families. And this is a slide that you're going to see several times during this talk. All of these, again, can be downloaded, printed off directly, and used in whatever way you see fit. And even advocacy. The web resource is hopefully able to help care providers be better advocates for their immigrant and refugee families at individual levels, system levels, or even policy levels. And this is essentially to have given you a bit of a sense, as I said, of where we've come from and what we've developed into. This is the Reader's Digest version of this journey, but hopefully you have an understanding at least of how we have evolved and where we're going with it. Now I'd like to move on to part two of the webinar, slide 35. And we're going to briefly discuss some of the ways that you can utilize the CKNC web resource to help with the medical assessment and screening of immigrant, refugee, children, and youth. And essentially, I will try to go over these 5 points. So we'll touch upon understanding newcomers' unique needs. We'll go over some of the diseases and conditions that are unique in a very brief sort of way, just to give you a sense of what we're dealing with, although many of you who work in this area obviously will know this already. The use of the screening tools available on the web resource. Why it's important to integrate mental health into your screening of immigrant and refugee children and youth new to Canada. And also understanding the needs of international adoptees, although we will discuss this only very superficially. So first and foremost, what about the unique needs of this population? Obviously, many of these children may not have even had a reliable or accurate health assessment along the way. Some of them have never even seen a physician in any significant manner before arrival into Canada. So you need to be prepared to diagnose health conditions that you may not have been familiar with prior and which may have affected the child's growth and development, and things like chronic diseases that have been underdiagnosed and or undermanaged, undiagnosed congenital problems, and psychosocial issues that are different from those that you may have seen with your native Canadian population need to be considered. It's critically important to inform yourself and your staff of the unique issues, as well as trying to reach out to the patients themselves about the differences in both the health conditions and the health practices from their country of origin relative to those in Canada. Also, it's ideal and useful to keep commonly required health information available and easily accessible, and if there's a particular population or cultural ethnic group that you work with, make sure that pamphlets are language appropriate. You might even choose to access the CKNC Taking a History Guide to help highlight some of the specific areas of differences and or focus. And again, I keep harping on this, but these guides really can make for great educational handouts for learners of any level and any discipline. Information about how to assess immigration history and immigration trauma, how to assess identity development and acculturation and where they are in their acculturation status and if there are any gaps available. You can read down the list of these, but basically keeping in mind that applying the lens of reviewing it from the perspective of immigrant and refugee health will allow you to be better in terms of your care provision in the future. And also how to approach these unique needs. The approach isn't exactly unique in the sense that it's motherhood and apple pie in many ways, complete history and a physical examination, appropriate investigations, etc. But being sensitive along the way to the cultural and language differences, being aware of the need for use of professional interpreters. This also requires often several visits because there may be a need early on to focus on an acute issue or focus on trust building, and this can be followed by further evaluation and information gathering at subsequent visits. And again, remembering the CKNC website can help guide you if you access the medical assessment pages, which I have listed here. And what does the approach look like? Well, keeping in mind again, chronic illnesses, diseases uncommon in Canada, as well as keeping in mind the physical and psychosocial problems that are different than children native to Canada. All of these can be found when you have an interaction with children new to Canada, and often several appointments are required to complete even the initial physical examination. Ideally, as well, it's important to keep in mind that each child in the family deserves their own time. It's not always practical, but certainly in an ideal situation, it's a great way to approach the family. As well, it allows you opportunity to continue to build trust and relationship building. Patience as well, doing a complete history is important, but as previously mentioned, you may need to have an ability to be focused on acute issues early on with evaluation of more in-depth social history, psychosocial history, emotional history as time progresses. And all of this is in the context of culturally appropriate and competent care. This again is a webinar unto itself. And remember that culturally appropriate care starts and ends with effective communication, be it verbal or nonverbal. Important to understand the relevance and need for interpreters, how best to work with them, how to arrange for their services in advance, and where to find appropriate alternatives. And as well, cultural competence has an ability to be expanded personally. Educate yourself about culturally appropriate care. There are programs, in fact, that can help improve your cultural competence, including components that can be found on the CKNC website. There's my use of interpreters again, as I continue to harp on that, and you see that repeated throughout my component of the presentation. But also knowing where your patient is coming from, literally and figuratively, is critical to truly understanding their situation, their perspective, and the acceptance of the information that you may provide them with. It's important to make sure that you understand how the patient understands what is happening and recognize that families may use complementary and alternative therapies, and remind them that doing so can delay or interfere with testing or treatment plans. If you can take time to assess the patient's support system, their language skills, and their stage of adaptation to Canada, all these factors can be important to providing the best possible care for the immigrant refugee family. And here you go again, the interpreters. Here's another useful checklist that you can get on the website. This checklist can be downloaded directly from the website and used as a practice tool, an educational opportunity, or an advocacy piece. And you may notice, if you have an opportunity to read through this, that we recommend on the website not to use children as interpreters, except perhaps in emergency situations. And many people ask why, but an accurate assessment of any newcomer child or youth requires complete communication without misunderstandings on either side, and placing that burden on a child is far too heavy a burden to do so and may negatively impact family dynamics. And in fact, we feel that it's such an important point that the CPS is developing a statement on this behalf, which will come out hopefully in the next 6 months. Now, we're on slide 45 for those of you following along. And I just wanted to go over briefly some examples of unique disease conditions, both infectious and non-infection, that may be seen in these children. So for example, infectious diseases, children coming to Canada age 0 to 4 are not routinely tested before they leave their country of origin, and it may not always be top of mind, as most HIV-exposed individuals in Canada are picked up either via a maternal history or an exposure concern that raises that issue. Obviously, this group, it needs to be considered, even if not initially top of mind at first visit. Also vaccinations, immunization records either may not exist or may be inaccurate or may be uninterpretable, and sometimes people need to take the presumptive attitude that immunizations are not up to date and need to vaccinate as if vaccinations have never been performed previously. There's information available on the website which we will go through that can help with that. As well, there's obviously infectious diseases specific to migration and migration journey. This map shows where the most common areas for malaria are, and keep in mind that the infection may not present itself for several weeks up to a month and post infectious exposure. Also tuberculosis, one of the globally most common infectious diseases, and the risk of which is highest in children under 5. Children coming to Canada under 11 do not have routine testing for TB and such. You need to keep that in mind. And again, keep in mind the migration path, because families may have emigrated from a non-endemic country but have spent time in a refugee camp in an endemic country or vice versa, which means that you need to consider this when assessing for fever of unknown origin. And health conditions that are non-infectious, things like malnutrition or micronutrients, it's less likely to be something textbook obvious like beriberi, but protein, calorie deficiencies, iron deficiency, and other micronutrients need to be considered in targeted screening potentially added to your evaluation for each child. And I must add that personally, apart from vitamin D and iron, almost all of the micronutrient deficiencies I've diagnosed in practice in quote-unquote normal children have been in immigrant refugee children or dietary restrictors. And anemias. Anemia is one of the most common medically identifiable problems for immigrant and refugee children and should be specifically screened for in all of these children. The long-term health implications can be significant, such as the neurodevelopmental effects of iron deficiency, and times it can even be catastrophic if not picked up, such as in sickle cell disease. And this is why anemia screening has been recommended essentially for all immigrant refugee children upon arrival in Canada. And now slide 50. Use of the screening tools that are actually online. The www.kidsnewtocanada web resource can be accessed, and as you proceed, you can just go to the website, click on assessment and screening, scroll down to the topic of interest or desire at that moment. So on to slide 52. You might decide that you want to review immunization status of a child in front of you, and this section can help you decide if your patient's vaccination status is actually up to date, resources for figuring out the appropriate catch-up regimen, and generally how to proceed with the logistics and timing of immunizations. The hearing screening section has excellent information on the rates of hearing deficits, the causes of hearing deficits worldwide, and how to identify at-risk individuals. It covers hearing screening as well as intervention and resources for your patient. Slide 54, what about vision screening? Here's a section outlining the answers to the commonly asked questions of how to, who, and what are we screening for, with a focus on the immigrant refugee population as well as the general population. And again, resources are provided, and even the barriers that prevent vision screening, not the least of which is lack of universal coverage, are reviewed in this section. Slide 55 shows oral and dental screening section, and you can see from the yellow and red discoloration on the map. I'm not exactly sure what goes on in South America, Eastern Europe, and Russia, but obviously there's something cariogenic in their environment. But this section can help with review of screening recommendations, resources, and again, ways of accessing care for the immigrant refugee population when it comes to oral and dental management, as this is generally not covered by IFH nor by most provincial health benefits plans. Slide 56, it's just a beginning section of how and why to incorporate mental health into screening of immigrant refugee children. As care providers, obviously we need to be cognizant of the physical aspects of caring for kids new to Canada, but also similar to their Canadian peers, their psychosocial issues. And one might argue that perhaps even more so given the variation in their migration journey, their often precarious situations upon arrival in Canada, and the potential for previously unmet mental health needs. Examples include depression. Now, rates of depression in children and youth new to Canada in general are felt to be lower and have been shown to be lower than their Canadian-born peers. However, the subgroup of refugee children has a higher rate of psychosocial stressors, including depression, and so this needs to be considered when you're screening these kids in your practice. Another example is post-traumatic stress disorder. This can be quite disabling condition, and if unmet from a mental health standpoint, can become chronic, and it requires both the awareness that it exists as well as the fact that it needs to incorporate family, community, and school involvement and a multidisciplinary approach to help break the cycle. Substance abuse. Generally, again, substance use disorders are felt to be less common in the immigrant population, but as time passes and acculturation occurs, this will increase, and youth from cultures that strictly prohibit substance use and strongly adhere to family authority have lower rates of substance usage, whereas those from countries where substance abuse is endemic will have higher rates than the general population as time moves on. And slide 60, being aware of international adoption is important. Again, this is an entire webinar unto itself, and I'll only touch upon it briefly to say that the Kids New to Canada web resource has an entire section on this. There are many tips on the website for care providers and the families, everything from helping prepare for pre-adoption as well through to post-adoption medical care, screening, ongoing care from physical mental perspective, and keeping in mind that both the adoptive parents and yourselves as care providers need to be aware of some of the particular risks that international adoptees bring with them when arriving in the country. And suffice to say that we feel the CKNC web resource can be an excellent adjuncted guide for care providers dealing with children and youth new to Canada. And I feel that it provides practical resources and guidelines that can be used in your day-to-day practice and for self-improvement and CPD activities. And on that note, I'd like to hand over the webinar to my colleague, Sue, who will move on to the e-checklist and other CKNC tools.
Hi. So this is Sue calling in from the other end of the country. And I'm really delighted, along with Tony, to be part of this webinar today. I would like to point out for those of you that may be familiar with geography in Alberta that I'm actually at the University of Calgary, not the University of Alberta, although I was there at some time in the past. It's really a delight to be able to go on here and explain a little bit more in depth about use of the screening tools that we have available here, most prominently the e-checklist, but also showing how it connects in with some of the other tools that are available through the website. So first of all, I do want to kind of re-emphasize something that Tony has mentioned as well, is you really need to do your background preparation in order to use a lot of the tools effectively. So certainly taking the time to read through that medical assessment that Tony showed earlier, along with things like taking history and many of the other special topics will certainly make you much more comfortable with using the e-checklist and other tools. I'm going to then go on and explain a little bit more about the specific resources. Both these here listed on slide 64 about symptoms, signs, clinical problems, health information by region, as well as some of the specific conditions that are listed on the website, which obviously could be used on their own or in connection with your e-checklist as you actually go through and screen a specific child. So starting with the background, if you go to your main page as shown here on slide 65, the top ribbon shows assessment and screening in the upper left. And this was where you'll find some of these main topics, as Tony pointed out, including the medical assessment. So certainly going forward to read through that, it can be extremely helpful. Once again, emphasizing things like chronic conditions that may be either unfamiliar to most of us working here or infrequently encountered are important, and the fact that multiple appointments are often going to be required and can be easily derailed and have to come back to complete screening at some point in time. So flexibility is definitely the buzzword to keep in mind. So certainly a tool that Tony showed there, taking a history with newcomer children, is one of the really useful ones. Some of the things that are pointed out on that one-page guide include the immigration history. That's exceedingly important in order to be able to interpret and use a lot of the other tools, is to find out where their country of origin may be. And that may be the origin of their parents, and the child themselves may in fact be born elsewhere. For example, a parent originated in Sudan, but the child was born in a camp in Ethiopia and then went through a subsequent refugee camp in Kenya. So the migration history is a really important set of detail to encounter. So when moving to some of the more specific tools that you can look at, I'd like to take you through this one here, which is on slide 68, Symptoms, Signs, and Clinical Problems, a Tool for Differential Diagnosis. When you click on that, it will take you to this page, which shows the tool itself. There are a listing of boxes with different specific symptoms that you can indicate. What I've checked here are the boxes for fever, headache slash seizure, and hepatomegaly slash splenomegaly. You'll notice at the bottom that there's another box that you can select, which says show only results that have all my selections. So that will get you a more narrowly defined listing of differential diagnoses, obviously, than if it could include any one of those particular findings. After you click on that, it will then generate a list for you, as you see here on slide 70. This shows possible differential diagnoses for that set of symptoms, and there are three results that come up. That doesn't mean there are only three, but as it indicates on the top of this box, it says do not miss. So do not miss HIV/AIDS, malaria, and viral hemorrhagic fever. In some cases, you will generate lists which also show some additional possibilities that are lower on the list of options, including those that are more common diseases to consider and less common diseases to consider as well. So this is by no means totally comprehensive, but is certainly meant to be a guide. The next tool I want to draw your attention to is Health Information by Region, which is also listed under the Assessment and Screening tab and the subset of tools and resources. This will give you quite a wide range of information, and for that reason, I really encourage you to take some time and peruse through it, because there's many different links available here that you would use for very different things. The first one I'd want to draw your attention to is in the first part of the page, Immigrant Health Needs by Country or Region of Origin. This is on slide number 72. Under the Global Health Observatory Map Gallery, you can click on that, and it can give you some very handy resources. Along with that, actually, before that, I wanted to point out some other listings as well. For example, if you click on health, one of the links will take you to health topics, which brings you to a WHO page, and where there are useful things under, for example, general information, fact sheets on tropical diseases. So if you want to learn more about a particular disease, particularly one that you don't find enough detail on our site or not on the site, this is a very useful place to go. Scrolling down to the interactive map section under international health, this is further down the same page, international traveler needs by country. This is useful not only for one of your patients, immigrant patients who's going to travel, but it still has some useful information for those on first arrival. So if you click on that, it takes you through to some useful maps provided by WHO. On the left-hand side of slide number 75, you'll see the diseases at risk listing. And what I've clicked on in order to generate this particular map is schistosomiasis, which as you see is basically involving the entire African continent, but also some other select places in the world that may not come to mind quite as readily. So why did we decide to create this e-checklist? Well, those of you who are already involved in immigrant and refugee health are probably familiar with the Canadian Collaboration for Immigrant and Refugee Health work, which was done several years before we embarked on this endeavor. One of the things that did get generated at the end of that project was a similar type of summary checklist. There is a whole host of comprehensive information that could be pulled together. We had the same similar issue here, a lot of great information, but how could we pull it together in a way that was actually useful to people on the front line? This proved to be fairly challenging, but what we hope we've achieved is some kind of synthesis of the web content. We were trying to incorporate not just strictly screening tests, but some degree of health promotion, which of course is critical in this population. We also wanted to incorporate some of the subgroup specific issues. So for example, where testing may vary by gender, by age, or by geographic origin. This sometimes can be very challenging to achieve, and we took a little different approach than the CCIRH checklist in this regard. Most of all, the whole concept is, of course, to try to create a consistent approach for those of us that care for this population, which may mean over time that hopefully as more information becomes known, this e-checklist can become more and more appropriate based on new and evolving information. So going on to slide number 77. So I've told you why we want to create a checklist, but how did we do it? Well, the answer is with a whole lot of time and effort, and certainly a lot more than I anticipated. We started with the medical assessment tool that we've pointed out already as our general framework of how many visits might we expect it to take, how to time those visits, and generally what are the sort of things that we're going to be looking for. We again went to other checklists such as CCIRH and some used by very experienced providers of immigrant health, such as in Minnesota, to get some more ideas and to make sure that we covered off what was most important. Then we went through all of the different diseases and conditions that we had on the web page and reviewed it vis-a-vis other good Canadian information, such as the CCIRH summaries themselves, which, as you know, are quite comprehensive. And then went on to look at as recent epidemiologic data as we could for diseases such as hepatitis C or HIV to actually operationalize and decide what regions should get which tests. Finally, we looked at formatting. How were we going to demonstrate different types of approaches by different geographic origins? One option would be to produce multiple checklists for people from different regions of the world, which is one way to approach it. We elected in the end to do a little bit more of a simplistic approach perhaps with trying to create a single checklist with some differentiation depending on where the person had come from or transited through. I must say, though, that this was an overwhelming amount of information at times and was almost enough to drown us, but somehow we've gotten through. So let's have a look at this e-checklist, which again is shown under the main assessment and screening tab under the tools and resources. You'll notice right at the outset that there is some indication of important considerations. Probably one of the most important is this proviso that it is just a guide and you do have to actually customize it for the individual in front of you. The other important thing that we can't emphasize enough is that these were not designed for use with international adoptees. And although there's a tremendous amount of overlap, they have their own section for specific reasons to which we would direct you. So I'd like to take a little break at this point to ask you about how confident you are with your current approach to screening of migrant children. Is it very much, somewhat, neutral, very little, or not at all? And it looks like we're closing in on the kind of middle range here. So from our respondents here, we're seeing approximately 60% of you are somewhat confident, about 12% in the neutral range, and 30% are very little. So I think all of us would probably see ourselves as fitting somewhere in that range because there always seems so much more to know. So hopefully I can now illustrate the actual pragmatic use of this tool going forward when you have a patient in front of you or who you know is coming in. You could admit to a little bit of artistic license with some of the cases, perhaps adding in what seemed like an unusual number of interesting conditions. But in fact, this isn't always that far from reality as well. But I certainly want to illustrate a full range of different parts of the tool for you to become familiar. So this is a 12-year-old female government-assisted refugee who comes to your office. She was born in the DRC, but spent the last year in Uganda. She and her family don't have any specific complaints. So what is going to be a part of your initial screening visit? Moving on to slide 82, I've clicked through to the medical assessment first page, the initial assessment, and this has to be divided into several pages as you'll see here, where in this case there's no parental concerns, you complete your physical and history, and this includes some of the screening assessments that Tony mentioned earlier. Moving on to the initial screening section, you'll see, again, as Tony alluded to, that all children get a CBC. And under serology, I've crossed off the two that don't apply to her because she is 12. She doesn't get either syphilis or varicella screening serology. So it focuses on the hepatitis serologies along with two stools for ovine parasite and TB testing, which may be a MAN2 or a Nigra test, depending on what is used in your area. Going on to the next section, this is how we differentiated between different geographic origins. Because she's from Africa, she'll get hemoglobin electrophoresis and G6PD testing, along with serology for strongyloides and schistosomiasis. Now, these last two are probably not something that's readily available for most of us, and in many cases has to be ordered through a specialty lab or sent through your provincial lab, and in our case, for example, is done in the National Parasitology Lab in Montreal. Within Africa, she's from sub-Saharan Africa, so HIV is done, but you'll see that star beside HIV, and if you go down to the bottom, the star says test for HIV if from this region and when any one of the following are present: age over 15, infected or deceased parent or sibling, suspected sexual abuse, blood product transfusion, or not accompanied by birth mother. So this is then not done in every child, but would be done selectively or if you ever have concerns because of clinical presentation at any point. Additional testing that is listed there would really have to be decided upon in each individual situation depending on your findings on history and physical, and may perhaps even be done at a later point, depending on what comes up in your screening or other conditions become apparent. I wanted to point out at the bottom here on slide 85 that additional testing to consider also indicates malaria smears. We really wanted to emphasize that at any time, if a child from an endemic area develops fever, even up to 12 months out from their arrival, you must consider the diagnosis of malaria. As Tony indicated, certainly in the first month is when we see a lot of them, but for a number of reasons, depending on where they originated from and the strain of malaria that they manifest, there is quite a bit of variability. So your testing is done in this child. She goes home and comes back a week later. We recommend somewhere in the 3 to 7 day return time if possible. Once again, you address specific parental concerns and complete anything that might not have been possible to do in the first visit. You then go on to review your different results. And in this case, you've identified eosinophilia as well as Schistosoma mansoni on one of her stool samples. As I mentioned, it may take a little while for your serology to come back. So later on, you may see this supported by schistosomiasis serology. And in addition, you will still want to review your strongyloides serology because it's yet another explanation for eosinophilia. And we certainly find Hickam's dictum often applies in the immigrant refugee population. In other words, there can be more than one thing going on. So you say, okay, it's been a while since I've treated schistosomiasis, so what do I do? Well, if you go to the medical conditions and find the gastrointestinal parasite infections, you can scroll down to find the section on cestodes, which includes schistosomiasis as here, and gives you your dose of praziquantel, or belcherside as it's also known, for treatment of this disease. So off your patient goes, and you ask her to come back in a month, which she does for a follow-up visit. In fact, she actually shows up about a week early. And on this occasion, her parents are concerned because she has had fever for the past 5 days. She has headache, fatigue, as well as a normal level of consciousness that has been maintained, and no evidence of neck stiffness to suggest meningitis. But obviously, you are concerned. So what can you do? You can go to the signs and symptoms page. When you plug in those symptoms, you get this list of do not miss. It includes HIV, TB, and viral hemorrhagic fever. But in this case, you're keeping in mind that reminder at the end of the previous visit to think about malaria. And you realize that she is coming from a region where you would definitely worry. So if you click on that malaria hyperlink, it can take you directly to malaria under the medical conditions part of the website, and you can scroll down, and here is a handy little flowchart that gives you an idea of how to proceed. This is taken directly from the Committee to Advise on Tropical Medicine and Travel. So here you'll see the blood work that needs to be done and what to do based on smear results. In her case, you find that she has a platelet count of only 45, hemoglobin of 121, a normal white count, and everything else is normal, but comes up positive for Plasmodium falciparum on the rapid diagnostic test. When the smear becomes available, it's a fairly low parasitemia, and her blood culture proves negative. We generally recommend admission for children who get Plasmodium falciparum regardless of the parasitemia, so this is what is done. Because it's a fairly low-level parasitemia, she's treated with Malarone, also known as atovaquone proguanil. She defervesces, and the smears are negative by day 3. However, as you get to know her a little bit more, the girl starts to open up to you. She tells you that before she got sick, she was having trouble sleeping and actually having nightmares as well. Her parents also acknowledge being concerned that she has become very withdrawn after the initial excitement of arriving in Canada, and they wonder what it is that's doing this to her. So moving to slide 94, you can then go to the mental health and development section, as Tony indicated, and go through some of the conditions that he's mentioned, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, and decide if her presentation may generally fit one of these and involve mental health providers and programs as is appropriate. So the next question for all of you participants is one that you should almost be able to answer based on the clues that Tony has given you up until this point. Which of the following tests are done by Citizenship and Immigration Canada in all children before they arrive? The MAN2 or other TB testing, a chest X-ray looking for active TB, a urinalysis, all of the above, or none of the above? And it's looking like the vast majority are saying none of the above. So I'm definitely preaching to the choir here. You realize that in no children are all things done. It's not until you're 5 years of age that you get a urinalysis. Isn't that useful? And it's not till 11 you get a chest X-ray. And serologic testing isn't done until age 15. Thanks, everybody. So let's move on to slide number 97 and to our second case. So this is a case of a 2-year-old boy who's been in Canada for a year. So this is just to remind you that not all patients are going to arrive with screening in mind upon arrival. It could be someone who's already been in your practice but has come in only for acute care, or who has not had a regular family physician. In this case, this boy arrived from Punjab a year before and have only been going to walk-in clinics for various minor illnesses. So now would like to see you as their regular family physician. So once again, we go to the beginning page as we saw before. And once again, because of age, this child would get the hepatitis screening, stools, and TB testing would be recommended. Going on further down to the region to look at what he would get based on his region of origin, it would be hemoglobin electrophoresis and G6PD along with hepatitis C. You'll see there's again some sub-areas such as Southeast Asia where something like strongyloides would be considered a high enough risk to do regular testing, but that is not where he is from. Again, you may consider some additional testing that is listed here, and you ask him to return in about a week's time. So when he comes for his follow-up visit and you complete what you had started previously, you ask the parents if they have any concerns. And they point out that they're actually planning a return visit for a big family wedding in the next few months. So with that in mind, you can go to the Health Promotion tab, look under Preventive Care, and see here the travel-related illness. If you click on that, there's an extensive page with a lot of different information. What I really want to emphasize is the fact that immigrants who return to their country of origin are what we call visiting friends and relatives. This can, however, also include children that are Canadian-born but to immigrant families, as they have very similar types of travel and therefore very similar types of risk. We know that VFR children are disproportionately affected by hepatitis A, typhoid, malaria, and any illness requiring hospitalization compared to any of our other Canadian-based travelers. So you really want to support them in going abroad, but to do so in the safest manner possible, including where they can get their pre-travel advice and care. Further down the list, it gives you some more information about immunizations and pre-travel preparation. So it does give you a bit of a primer on the type of things that should be covered off in a prenatal or pre-travel assessment. Going further down, you're going to review the results of the testing that you did initially. And lo and behold, you find that he has a beta thalassemia trait. And in addition, this is the reason why we do the hepatitis A screening. This child is hepatitis A immune, not surprising, having migrated at the age that he has. But this is an important piece of information to be able to offer them so that when they do go for pre-travel clear, he does not require the hepatitis A vaccine, which otherwise would be one of the first that's recommended. So he disappears. He doesn't come back for his next follow-up visit. It takes 6 months before the mom returns with the child. This is on slide number 106. He's been febrile now for 5 days, along with headache, abdominal pain, and a bit of diarrhea at the start of the illness. These symptoms began 2 weeks after he returned home from the trip to India. They had decided against going to a travel clinic prior to the trip because of the cost. He has a temperature of 40 degrees, he looks ill, and he has a bit of tenderness in the right upper quadrant. So how can you approach this problem? Well, once again, we can go to our handy dandy signs and symptoms page. Once again, we input the symptoms, abdominal pain, fever, and diarrhea, and we'll see what's generated. So 7 different results come up. The top 5 are under the more common diseases to consider. And as you see here, it includes E. histolytica, which is certainly a good thought, enteric fever, and then things like Giardia, Strongi, and viral gastro, which are probably a little lower down the list given how ill I described the patient. So you do your initial blood work and find a normal CBC, but elevated liver enzymes, but only slightly, negative malaria smear, blood cultures cooking, and stools are sent. Clicking on the enteric fever as probably being the condition of greatest concern here in the short time period will take you directly to enteric fever under the medical conditions. Scrolling down, you can see then antimicrobial therapy that's recommended includes empirical parenteral ceftriaxone. This is because of the concern, particularly in South Asia, as you can see in the map on 109, you'll see the very dark red in the nalidixic acid-resistant strains reported throughout South Asia, which is why we go directly to ceftriaxone, because there was already quite significant resistance to ampicillin and ceftra really throughout the world. So that at least gives you a head start on how you're going to proceed with care of this particular child. So with that in mind of VFRs, have any of you had a child, a patient, who was a migrant, or it could be the child of a migrant who returned from visiting friends and relatives with any of the following diseases? Malaria, typhoid, or one of the other enteric fevers, or dengue?
Okay, and I'm going to open up this. You know what? Let's ask people to post their answers in the text chat.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay. Who votes for?
Who has seen malaria? Who has seen enteric fever? Or dengue in any of these patients?
Yeah, so if people can put in the list of the maladies, that would be helpful. So a couple of people, someone saying a couple of cases of typhoid. Someone else, malaria and typhoid. Yes, malaria. Someone saying none. A few people saying none. Ooh, several malarias there. 1, 2, 3, 4. And dengue.
So we've got some experienced caretakers in the audience here, and certainly illustrates just how important all of these, but particularly malaria and enteric fever, are in this particular population. So the very ones that are the hardest to get into care of, the most barriers to receiving pre-travel care, are actually have the highest risk of exposure. So let's go on to case number 3. This is slide number 111. This is a 10-year-old girl who presents to your office, recently arrived from Medellin in Colombia. Her family are economic migrants, so quite a different category, you would think, than our first case or the second one. Her mom was a known hepatitis B carrier, but the child did receive hepatitis B immune globulin and the appropriate 3 doses at the appropriate times of hepatitis B vaccine, and you have documentation of this. So you go on to your initial screening, as in slide number 112, and once again we have the same set of investigations as in our 2 previous cases. You'll notice here that in this geographic region, there is no listing of any specific additional tests. So although from the Caribbean, There is a bit more testing. There's nothing over and above what we've already mentioned recommended, at least routinely, for someone from South America. However, when you go on to additional tests to consider, because of the maternal history of hepatitis B and potential for transmission, it would seem appropriate to at least do your liver enzymes and possibly more. So they return in a week, and lo and behold, they appear to have become, unfortunately, hepatitis B carrier in spite of the appropriate prophylaxis. Not uncommonly, I must say, from an infectious disease point of view, we do encounter these patients referred often years and years after the transmission would have occurred, where because the appropriate prophylaxis has been given, it is assumed that it will be 100% protective, and unfortunately it's not the case. It is very high, but not 100%. In this child's case, we've also noted that she has a thrombocytopenia and a slight elevation in her liver enzyme. So this would be a child that you would want to send on for further hepatitis B care as appropriate. So she was going to come back for a second follow-up visit, but before that happens, you get a call from the emergency department of your local hospital. Your patient has presented with an afebrile generalized seizure. So once again, we can go to the input of seizures into that symptoms and signs page. In this case, what we've generated is a list of 8 conditions, four of which you can see on slide 117. So the do not miss conditions included cysticercosis, HIV/AIDS, malaria, TB, etc. Now, in this case, the child really didn't have any fever or other symptoms to suggest the latter three of those options. So let's have a closer look at cysticercosis to see if that is something that appears to be relevant in this case. So once again, you can go over to the detailed information column on this differential list and actually click on cysticercosis to go directly for more information. Or you can go through the medical conditions tab and you'll see cysticercosis and teniasis shows up as one of the infectious disease options. Once you get to that page and scroll down, you want to say, well, is this something I have to worry about for this part of the world? Well, as you see here, probably most parts of the world are a potential concern for this condition. But in fact, South America lights up as a very dark blue, so a very fairly high risk, high frequency location to encounter this particular condition. So cysticercosis is basically pork tapeworm that's found its way to the brain. Not surprising, a febrile seizure presentation in a child with potential for conditions such as this, a CT scan is done. What you'll see on this example, this is an actual patient from some years ago, there's a cystic lesion in one of the hemispheres and evidence of edema around it. This would be very typical of cysticercosis where you have a cyst that starts to break down. Until that time, it's completely encapsulated and the patients can go years and years with absolutely no symptoms or signs whatsoever. But once breakdown starts to occur, inflammation results, and this is often when seizures are the presentation. Also on the same information page is further information about how the presentation occurs and as well how to make a diagnosis. This is a really helpful life cycle which demonstrates why with stool testing, you may have noticed I didn't say anything about tapeworm showing up in her screening stools. Well, this is because the cysticercosis is a result of infection by eggs. So either you have to have a tapeworm that excretes eggs, you don't wash your hands and you consume the eggs, or someone else with a tapeworm excretes eggs, doesn't wash their hands and prepares your food, and therefore you're infected with the eggs, which can then basically treat the human as a pig, and you have larvae form in places like the brain. This will also give you an idea about how to treat. So this is the end of our kind of practical examples and how you can use the e-checklist to tour through the website as a whole or to use different aspects of it for an individual patient. hopefully that gives you a bit of a flavor on how this could be used with a patient in front of you in your day-to-day work with immigrants and refugees. So hopefully we've given you a sense of just how extensive the information is on this website in general, including quite a number of tools that are useful both in an individual or for background information, which synthesize a lot of this information, particularly the e-checklist, which can then be used as a guide for an individual child. So we do want to leave you with one last question, which you're welcome to answer, or you can answer through the SurveyMonkey, where some additional questions will be asked of you. So for those of you that are with us, how do you think you will use this information in your work going forward? You'll visit the website, share the information with colleagues, recommend the website to others, use it to support an existing initiative, or perhaps even start a new one. And the more, the merrier. So it looks like everybody's going to use the website, which is tremendously reassuring. And most of you as well will share the information, which we really appreciate. Please spread the gospel, as Tony would say, and bring as many others to the website as you can. Thank you very much. So once again, we do recommend that you go to the SurveyMonkey to give us your thoughts about the webinar that you've heard today. Thanks very much.
Excellent. Here on slide number 125 is the link to the SurveyMonkey there, and opportunity for you folks to ask some questions. I see Elizabeth from CPS has indicated the webinar is accredited for MOC. If you need a certificate of attendance for CMA, you can mail her, and she's very kindly put her email address there. Great, thanks. Wonderful. And a reminder, so if you have a question, please do ask it here. I do have one question that was earlier. It's from slide number 83. And the question is, the Hep B core total antibody was not indicated as a screening test for Hep B, only Hep B surface antigen and surface antibody. So why would that be?
This is Sue. This was actually initially something that I had included. However, with further review with the reviewers of the e-checklist, including those working intimately with hepatitis B, they felt the value was not sufficient to be done on a routine basis, and therefore we did consciously include only the core total antibody and the surface antigen as part of the screening, at least.
Wonderful. Thank you. And Karen Lisa is saying, great presentation. Website has very useful resources. Thanks, Karen. That's great. We've got about 10 minutes available for you folks. So if you have some questions or want to make some comments about the website itself, opportunity is here. And I'll be quiet for a minute so you can type out your question if you have one. Sometimes it takes a little while to formulate the question and then another bit of time to actually type it. Thanks. Some nice comments coming in via email. Maureen was saying, wish my participation was through the Adobe Connect and not via email. I'm really enjoying the presentation. That's great. Yeah. Some places have firewalls. Santina's saying, that was really helpful. Now I have a better idea how to navigate the website. Lots of some positive feedback there for you. Okay. Wow. Here you go. Thank you. Someone from Laval. Is there any similar work for adult immigrants and refugees?
In fact, there is. I mentioned the Canadian Collaboration for Immigrant and Refugee Health, CCIRH, and you can actually access that through the website as well. there's a huge amount of information that was created. I was involved in that as well. There were comprehensive evidence-based assessments of multiple topics, which we did utilize as part of the e-checklist formulation here as well. That information was all published through the CMAJ, in fact, although most of the detailed stuff is all in appendices because it was quite voluminous. But it was synthesized into a geographic-specific series of checklists as well. I'll just actually see if I can find the...
That would be helpful.
Okay, so the actual website to go directly to it is www.ccirhken.ca. And then if you go /ccirh/checklist, you'll actually get to the opening page of the checklist itself, and it'll list regions like North Africa, Caribbean, etc. You'll notice that there are children included in this, but for a number of reasons, given some of the other issues we want to include, etc., we elected to do our own separate checklist as well. But this is fantastic work, and highly recommend that you look at. And if you have the fortitude to actually read through the detailed reviews of some of the topics.
Fantastic. What a great resource. And I've just posted that in two, I'll do better, in two sections on the text chat, and we'll get that out to participants via the follow-up email, and I'll post it on the info registration page so folks can access it. Oh, here we go. Two comments and questions. Thank you. First one from Jenna. I noticed that your testing suggested CBC and HGB
electrophoresis.
Thank you. Together, it's my understanding that HGB electrophoresis should not be done until IDA is corrected. Is it your practice to wait and run HGB electrophoresis after correcting IDA to prevent false negative testing?
Tony, can you address that?
Yeah, in practice, I personally do both together. Given the difficulty at times making sure that patients come back, the hemoglobin electrophoresis, although you can have false negatives, still is best done the first time upon first visit, and then if there's still iron deficiency and you correct it and still have that patient available to you within your practice, it can always be repeated. So I tend to run it the first time, and then if there's still iron deficient or we identify iron deficiency, I will run it a second time after it's been corrected.
Oh, okay. Jenna, you can respond to that if you like. And Santina asked a question. Always wondered, when individuals first come to Canada, do they receive any information about how to access health care? This website is very helpful information, but in reality could only be used when we as healthcare providers come into contact with the newcomers. However, as mentioned, in one of the cases, often newcomers only visit a physician if there is an acute concern. Any comments?
So in terms of what newcomers to Canada receive, they do receive some guidance as to how to access their own personal health identifier, whether it's IFH or then proceeding through the process to receive their provincial coverage. This website itself has been initially developed to be a care provider dependent or care provider targeted for now. As we have gone through this process, however, we realize that it does have applications potentially for the actual families themselves, and the next phase of our evolution of the web resource will be to try to include portals that families can be directed to, which will allow them to access resources for themselves as opposed to being only recipients of information from individuals who are using the web resource as care providers. that's a next phase evolution that we're hoping to get done over the next several years.
Oh, answer for you there. And Santini, you can respond to that if you like. I have a request, Susan, if you wouldn't mind copying or typing into the text chat there on the Adobe Connect, if you can type in the, or put in, copy would be better, the correct website that you listed. It was the,
right,
the checklist one, because I just tried the one that I was trying to type as you were talking, and I didn't do it.
Okay.
So.
Well, I'll copy in the one that is takes you directly to the checklist.
Oh, I think Nadia has put it in there. I think we're good.
You were missing an I.
I think so. Okay, we've got it now, so I can send it out. Thank you. Great. And some people are typing, so I'm going to give them a minute. Here we go. From Karen, if a patient is asymptomatic, would you only consider screening for micronutrient deficiencies such as vitamin A, zinc, etc., based on a dietary screening history?
Tony, maybe you can take that one.
Yeah, no, generally, depending on how significant the concern about the dietary history is, unfortunately, there's no standard, apart from iron perhaps, there's no real standard evidence-based approach to micronutrient deficiency screening. But if coming from an endemic area or an area where there's clearly a significant dietary restriction or a concern, I don't hesitate personally again to do vitamin A and zinc and often almost always iron to start and then proceed from there.
Okay, thank you.
If I can just point out, this is one of the things that Tony alluded to in his introduction, is that in the process of doing this, we realize just how many gaps there are in information to really guide what is appropriate and it makes the most sense to be doing, and this is certainly one big area.
Thank you. Okay, and Elizabeth has posted some information about the CNC website along with the other webinars about the series. That's great. Okay. We are at 2:25. So opportunity here for you folks, the presenters, if you have a special last thought that you'd like to leave with our participants today, what would that be? And again, you've got just a few minutes, lots of time for you to explain it. So why don't we go ahead? So we start with Tony and then over to Susan.
So I've said most of what I want to say in the my time, but I guess a couple things. One, obviously, remember www.kidsnewtocanada.ca. Put it on your favorites tab and please play around with the site. I think the more you use it and experience it, the more useful you will have it. And certainly if you have the opportunity to have a patient in front of you, it's an excellent tool, but you need to become comfortable with navigating it just like any other website. Secondly, I just want to bring attention to June 15th, I believe, is the National Doctors for Immigrant and Refugee Health Day, and there will be a number of activities across the country, and I'm sure in each of your local communities there will be opportunities for you to advocate on behalf of this extraordinarily at-risk population. So get out there and try to raise awareness. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. Susan.
I guess I would echo what Tony has said and I'd really get on the site and explore it. Like as we go through, I'm always finding new things myself. Just when I think I've seen all of it, there's more to discover. So really encourage you to take some time and test out the limits of what we have on there. And also don't hesitate to contact us. If you have some ideas, there is a contact us link on the website. So if you have ideas, we do have the task force going forward. So if there's new things maybe directly relating to the website itself, or perhaps things that you think are important that our task force should really be drawn attention to, please let us know, and we'd really appreciate your input. For those of you who might be coming to the Canadian Pediatric Society meeting later this month, Tony and I will bring our dog and pony show on the road once again, but maybe with a slightly different twist, and we'd certainly welcome seeing you and chatting with you in person.
That's tremendous. It's a good dog and pony show, too. Okay. With that, we will finish up for today and wish you all well as you going on to whatever's next in your day and also your work on this particular area, welcoming our and taking good care of our new kids coming here to Canada. So with that, I will end the teleconference call. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.